This is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman. United States says it plans to issue temporary waivers to several countries, allowing them to continue purchasing Iranian oil without being subject to reimposed U.S. sanctions going into effect today. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo appeared on Fox News Sunday, where he spoke about all of this.
I am very confident that the sanctions that will be reimposed this Monday, not only the crude oil sanctions, but the financial sanctions that are being put in place by the Treasury Department and over 600 designations of individuals and companies in Iran, will have the intended effect to alter the Iranian regime's behavior. That's our expectation. It's the reason for President Trump's policy.
The nuclear deal with Tehran was okay during the Obama administration, allowing some sanctions on Iran to be lifted, and in turn, Iran would allow total access to its nuclear program. President Trump said Iran violated that 2015 agreement. The husband of a Pakistani Christian woman acquitted after spending 8 years on death row on blasphemy charges is appealing to President Trump and other world leaders for refuge. Asia Bibi says she was falsely accused after a heated argument with other women who refused to drink water she had given them because she was a Christian. 80% of the 2,600 victims of violence that Médecins Sans Frontières has treated in the town of Kananga in the Democratic Republic of Congo since May last year report having been raped by armed men. According to MSF, the rape victims, 162, were children under the age of 15. 22 of them were under the age of 5. Meantime, the UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling for an immediate halt to attacks by armed groups in the DRC who are jeopardizing response to the Ebola outbreak. This is VOA News. UN officials and volunteers from the Syrian Arab Red Crescent are vaccinating children as well as distributing desperately needed aid for the first time in a remote camp for the displaced on Syria's border with Jordan. Spokesperson said Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomes the delivery of humanitarian aid and is calling for continued full, safe, sustained, and unimpeded humanitarian access to all the people in need throughout the country. Also, the UN World Food Program spokesperson Dina El-Kassab said the last time that the UN reached that remote camp was in January this year.
This convoy is bringing a huge relief to the families that are there, but what's really important for us is to emphasize the need for continued access. We need to have access to these families, these people. I mean, 2/3 of the camp are women and children, so we need to have regular access to them so that we can support them on an ongoing basis.
Russia, a close ally of the Syrian government, blames the United States for the deterioration of the situation in the camps for the displaced. The U.S.-led coalition has denied such allegations and blamed Russia and the Syrian government instead. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he is resuming denuclearization talks with North Korea, and he would be doing that this week.
I'll be meeting this week in New York City with my counterpart Kim Jong-chol. We'll have a good opportunity to continue the denuclearization discussions that were set out just a few months back. It seems like a long time ago in news world, but it was just this past June when President Trump and Chairman Kim met and set us on the path that we're on today. We haven't had any missile tests. There have been no nuclear tests. We've had the returns of American remains. These are all good steps. We're continuing to negotiate with the North Koreans to achieve what President Trump set out, the full denuclearization verified by the United States of the Korean Peninsula, and then a brighter future for the North Korean people.
Pompeo appeared on Fox News Sunday, where he also dismissed Friday's threat from Pyongyang, which said it would seriously consider resuming its nuclear testing if U.S. economic sanctions against North Korea are not lifted. The mayor of the U.S. city of North Ogden, Utah, Brent Taylor, was an apparent victim of a so-called insider attack, fatally shot by an Afghan trainee on Saturday. The military intelligence officer, the father of seven, was expected to return home in January. Another American was wounded. And the trial of accused Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman begins today in New York with jury selection. Mexico extradited Guzman to the United States in 2017, and ever since he has been held in solitary confinement. He has pleaded not guilty to charges of running a massive drug trafficking operation in North America. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Monday, November 5th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The Cameroon government says all is set for President Paul Biya's 7th inauguration tomorrow, Tuesday.
The swearing-in ceremony is under intense and acute preparation. All the pieces of the puzzle are being put in place in order to make this ceremony one of the best ever held in our nation.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's information minister. Eswatini's new cabinet begins work today, but the banned opposition Putemo says the cabinet is based on nepotism. A Somali town receives health care after nearly three decades of conflict, and Nigeria's military defends its interaction with the country's Shiite movement.
The military has ever been used to stop Shiite movement from protesting. But because Shiite movement never recognized Nigerian state, whenever they see the military in the course of their duty, they are always ready to obstruct the military from doing their job.
Brigadier General John Ajima is the Nigerian defense spokesman. There is a new determination to end violence against journalists in East Africa. And we'll tell you about the rape culture in a town in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Paul Biya will tomorrow, Tuesday, take his 7th oath of office in the capital, Yaoundé. Mr. Biya was declared winner of the October 7th presidential election with over 71% of the total votes cast. Opposition candidate Maurice Kamto, who came second, has called for the setting up of an independent international committee to supervise a recount of the results. Cameroon's Constitutional Court last month dismissed a petition by Kamto and other opposition parties calling for the annulment of the results. Issa Chiroma Bakari, Cameroon's information minister, says Kamto and other losing candidates must respect the rule of law. He says Cameroonians are ready for tomorrow's inauguration.
The swearing-in ceremony is under intense and acute preparation. All the pieces of the puzzle are being put in place in order to make this ceremony one of the best ever held in our nation.
What do you say to Mr. Maurice Kamto? He still thinks that there should be an international committee set up to supervise a recount of the ballots.
We are a democratic nation where the freedom of press, freedom of speech is acknowledged. He has lost the election. There is no doubt about it. Mr. Biya scored five times the result of Mr. Kamto. So, no problem. He's free to say what he wants, but he understands that his responsibility is to abide by the law.
Minister, he says that the Constitutional Council that declared President Paul Biya the winner was biased in favor of the president.
He knows the constituent of the electoral body that we call ELECAM. If he disagrees with their composition, was not obliged to introduce an application and to run for the presidential election. Let him not ridicule himself. Cameroonians are very well aware. Now he became a tool into the hand of those who would like to destabilize this nation. He became a daydreamer. I am sorry to say this, but this is just what he is, daydreamer.
I think now the people of the English-speaking region will be looking up to President Paul Biya to see what he would do to bring the country together. Because your country right now, I would say, is divided.
The country is not divided at all. Unfortunately, a handful of violent secessionists have taken hostages, our brothers and sisters in the two regions. But we are very much grateful that many of them overcome their fear. And they went to the polling station to cast their ballot, and this has taken place. Unfortunately, the turnout has not been one we wish to be. But those who were courageous enough to do it, they went there, and we are very much delighted. Election has taken place in the two regions, and the result is already known.
Minister Chiroma Bakari, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you on Daybreak Africa.
Merci beaucoup. Merci. Toutes mes amitiés. Merci beaucoup. Thank you.
Issa Chiroma-Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The Nigerian military has been explaining whether it retweeted a video in which U.S. President Donald Trump reportedly said that if migrants threw rocks at U.S. military, the U.S. military will fight back. The Nigerian military has been accused of killing as many as 40 Shiite marchers over the last week. Amnesty International has criticized the Nigerian military for a strong-handed response. Brigadier General John Ajim, the Nigerian defense spokesman, says at least six people were killed and seven wounded. He said the Shiites attempted to stop the Nigerian military from doing its job and that no country in the world would allow that to happen to its military.
Let me say that the military has never been used to stop Shiite movement from protesting. But because Shiite movement never recognized Nigerian state, whenever they see the military in the course of their duty, they are always ready to obstruct the military from doing their job. And I want to believe that there is no country in any part of the world that their chief of army staff will be obstructed from doing official duty. And their life will be at risk in doing that duty, that they will allow it to go free.
Did the army put on its Twitter account this video of President Trump? And then with the quote here that we have, please watch and make your own deductions. Did the army put that video on, and what was the purpose of it?
The director of army populations, they posted out the Trump video account where he said that if anybody used stones on the American military, they should reply back with a rifle. Now, here we have child movements. They are using petrol bombs. They are using rifles. Is it actually true that they don't have arms, or is some people who are sponsoring them to destabilize Nigerian security, they are putting those narratives? Because the police arrested them with petrol bombs. They arrested them with stones. They arrested them with nails that they welded together, which they are using to aim at security agents. And the Nigerian military have never been used to stop their protests. If there's anybody that will talk about the issue of protest, it's the Nigerian police. And the Nigerian police have arrested them having some arms and ammunition when they are in protest. And they're taking them to court. Why should Amnesty International come out to say that they were not armed? Is it true that they do everything to ensure that they paint the Nigerian security agents black so that they don't have support when they are fighting terrorism and insurgency? That is the question we want to find out.
I did speak to a spokesman for the Islamic movement who indicated to me as many as 40 people died. What is the true number?
The number of people that died were 6 people and 7 wounded. But Amnesty International sent out a press release that 45 of Shiite movement died and 132 wounded. So the narrative of Shiite movement, they are taking from what Amnesty International said. Amnesty International, right from 2012 to 2013, they have insisted that no country should support Nigeria in the fight against the insurgents, because if you support Nigeria, security agents will use the weapons against their citizens.
You said that the Shiite do not recognize the Nigerian state. How does the Nigerian government recognize the Shiite? Are they Nigerians or are they what?
We have shared movement that look at Iran as a spiritual headquarters of their movement. We have shared that they disagree with Al-Zazaki group and they are having their own groups. They refuse to disorganize and destabilize Nigeria.
Brigadier General John Ajim is the Nigerian defense spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, November 5th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, has begun providing life-saving health care to two Somali towns previously inaccessible because of war and conflict. This was made possible after the government recently liberated the towns of Gobwin and Bola Gadu in southeastern Somalia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Tens of thousands of people in the towns of Gobwein and Bulagadud have been deprived of life-saving health care for nearly three decades. These areas have been too dangerous for aid workers to reach because of the never-ending cycles of war and conflict in the area. In recent months, International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman says government forces have succeeded in subduing the armed groups that have made life a misery for local inhabitants. This, he says, has opened up these areas to outside help.
For the past 27 years, war and conflict have made healthcare access difficult or impossible in many parts of the country. Now, these communities have access to vaccinations, malaria treatment, antenatal care for pregnant mothers, malnutrition screenings and referrals, among other essential health services.
Millman says aid agencies who finally were able to reach these towns were dismayed by the prevailing conditions. He says they found high levels of malnutrition and extremely poor immunization coverage. Because the towns had no humanitarian services, he says many people had abandoned their villages. He says they were living in overcrowded settlements in faraway urban centers where medical care was available. He says it is likely many of these displaced people will decide to return to their communities now that the life-saving aid they need can be had closer to home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the new 18-member cabinet announced last week by Prime Minister Ambrose Dlamini is expected to begin work today, Monday. Six members are women, including Princess Sikinyiso, the daughter of King Mswati III, Mario Masuku, leader of the banned People's United Democratic Movement, known as PUDEMO, says the new cabinet is based on nepotism.
It is a strange composition of a cabinet, in that you have members of his family in there, which we were saying, we've always been saying, that give the people the power to elect a government of their own. We've got his daughter as a cabinet minister, but we are asking, where does he base the legitimacy of appointing a daughter? His brothers are in there. Fine. Having done that, we are all looking forward to a cabinet that will deliver to the people, but we know clearly that they are not answerable to the people anyway. The people have got no power to either withdraw or do anything in that cabinet.
The fact that the king has appointed six women as part of this cabinet, isn't that a credit to the king, the fact that he's trying to broaden the gender representation?
Yeah. We want women to have a say in leadership of any country, leadership of any organization, but not on favoritism, based on nepotism, based on authoritarianism. There are six women, and most of those women that are in there are his relatives. So there is no way I am going to give him a credit on a wrong formula of composition. You cannot find a good in a wrong formula.
Suppose King Mswati III had reached out to you and said, Mr. Masuku, I'd like for you to be a part of my cabinet. Would you accept?
I wouldn't, unfortunately for him, accept an appointment based on the current situation. It is a democratic process that is people-centered, that is answerable to the people, where the people are able to withdraw any person who does not deliver according to the people's mandate. We believe in a formula where political parties, based on the freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and of expression, are going to form a government of their choice, but not how he has done it.
Mr. Masuku, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you again.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Mario Masuku is leader of the banned People's United Democratic Movement, PUDEMO Party. He was speaking with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Regional media houses are set to cooperate with the East African Assembly and the African Court on Human and People's Rights to end impunity on crimes committed against journalists. This comes after UNESCO wrote a letter inquiring into the status of investigations regarding the killing of journalists in East Africa. Moses Aviarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
despite the strengthening of the international legal framework on safety of journalists over the past 5 years, through the adoption of more than 10 resolutions by the United Nations organization. 1,010 journalists and media workers have been killed since 2006. Sylvain Auré, the president of the African Court for People and Human Rights, says only two cases were handled by the court, including the case of investigative journalist Norbert Zongo, brought against the Burkina Faso government. Zongo was murdered in 1998, and his killing became the symbol against the government of then President Blaise Compaoré's rule.
The African Court of Human and People's Rights indeed received some cases, and we made some landmark decisions on freedom of expression and protection of journalists. The decision was that we cannot put journalists in jail because of what they have written.
According to UNESCO's World Trends on Freedom of Expression and Media Development 2017-2018 report, attacks and harassments of journalists, particularly online platforms, have increased significantly. Somalia is part of the list of countries where it is not safe for journalists, as at least 57 journalists were killed since 1992. Hassan Gese is the chairman of the Somali Independent Media Houses Association.
Somalia continues to be one of the dangerous countries to be a journalist. This year, only 2018, we lost 4 journalists. To be a journalist in Somalia, it's not easy. The main threat coming from mainly Al-Shabaab and also Somali government soldiers as well, but we are trying to sacrifice ourselves to inform our people.
Uganda has been the latest country where security forces have been accused of beating and torturing journalists. Ofwono Pondo is the spokesman of the Ugandan government.
We don't tolerate abuse of any kind. However, in the system, there will always be black sheep. But obviously, it has been a matter of concern that it appears to be recurring. The president has given direction about engagement with the media, and we hope the security agencies that have been the main abusers will heed.
Only 1 out of the 10 of the cases of 1,010 journalists and media workers who were killed since 2006 were brought to court. After the meeting in Arusha, regional media and associations to protect journalists are expected to partner with the East African Legislative Assembly and the African Court to end impunity on crimes committed against journalists. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
80% of the 2,600 victims of violence that Medecins Sans Frontieres has treated in the town of Kananga in the Democratic Republic of Congo since May last year report having been raped by armed men. According to MSF, of the rape victims, 162 were children under the age of 15 and 22 of them were under the age of 5. Carol Jensen, MSF's head of mission in the DRC, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the level of sexual violence, which the group says is new to the area.
This is specific on Kasai Central. We have a team of Doctors Without Borders there since May 2017, providing different sorts of medical care and with one health center specifically for victims of sexual violence. And over the course of the past 16 months, we have seen more than 2,600 victims who came to our clinic. So we are new in Kasai Central, but these levels of violence in Kasai Central are new to us as well.
Of the 2,600 victims of sexual violence, 32 were men. My question is not just that they were men, but it seems that they were reported to having been forced under armed threat to rape members of their own community. So I can imagine that, is that something you've seen in other clinics? Because that seems like a very specific psychological violent tool of warfare to tear a community apart, really.
Yeah, so over 2,600 victims, and indeed amongst them, some children and also some men. And it shows the level of violence, and it also shows how this kind of violence will affect not only the people, the victims themselves, but also how it will affect communities, whole communities, for months and even years to come. And part of the reason why we are bearing witness today of this, of what we see in our health center, center there is also to appeal to have more actors and more attention going to the aftercare, socio-economic support for victims of sexual violence. So there's a whole care that has to be provided afterwards that currently is not there or way too little of it is available to victims.
You mentioned children as among those victims, and your report said that 22 of those were under the age of 5.
It's a level of violence that, if I can give you an example, there's this one woman who came to our clinic. She had her husband killed. She had her daughter being raped, and afterwards she was raped as well.
That was Kara Jansen, head of mission for Medecins Sans Frontières in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You're speaking to Ricky Stryker from Brussels. It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin in New York City, where Mary Kitiani of Kenya and Lilisa Disisa of Ethiopia won the New York City Marathon on Sunday, with Mary Kitiani dominating the strong women's field for her fourth victory in the event, and Lilisa Disisa surging ahead of two other runners near the finish line. Disisa held off countryman Shura Kitita by 1.99 seconds for his first win in New York, joining victories at the Boston Marathon in 2013 and 2015. He missed second in New York in 2014 and third in 2015 and 2017. Lilisa Disisa finished in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 59 seconds, the second fastest time for the course in history.
I participate, number 2, number 3, and one time I DNF. This year, I decided to champion because I did hard training. Everything control. I save my power, and I saw athletes, especially my partner training athlete Shura Kitata. Amazing him.
In the women's category, Mary Kitiani, who won in 2014, 2015, and 2016 before coming in second last year behind American Shalane Flagan, joined Grete Woods, who won the marathon 9 times between 1978 and 1988 as the only women to win the marathon 4 times. Mary Kitiani pulled away at the 19-mile mark and held a 1 hour, 27 minutes, 83-second lead at the 21-mile mark. From that point, the question was not whether Kitiani will win, rather it was by how much. She beat countrywoman Vivian Cheruiyot by 3 minutes 13 seconds.
I thank God for the victory. I'm really happy for winning today again for the fourth time. I know last year was second, and I did not give up. I go back home, I train, and I say, okay, next time I will try my best. And that's why I've come today and got a good weather for running.
And on to football news. The CAF Champions League final first leg match between Al Ahly of Egypt and Esperance of Tunisia was marred by controversial refereeing calls. There were 3 penalties on the night, including 2 controversial ones, which went to the Egyptians as Ahly sealed a 3-1 win that certainly didn't go down well with a travelling contingent. We stay in North Africa, where Egypt's Zamalek has been given a final 90-day deadline by FIFA to pay the dues of former players Alexis Mendomo if they are to avoid being deducted points in the Egyptian Premier League. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, November 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be cooking. Is it a woman's job only? This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
She said she too young, don't want no man.
Starting Monday, November 5th, tune into Border Crossings to win a free copy of Now 68, featuring top songs from a variety of artists. This CD features Calvin Harris's One Kiss, along with Ariana Grande's God Is a Woman, and many other hit songs. Tune into Border Crossings to win.